Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Today, we're going to explore energy and our environment. And our special guest today is Dr. Reese Halter. Dr. Halter is a conservation biologist with a PhD from the University of Melbourne. And he also attended Humboldt State University and received the President's Distinguished Service Award. And he also has a gold medal for conservation from the Daughters of the American Revolution. He is the host of Dr. Reese's Planet on Time Warner and PBS Television, and the founder of Global Forest Science, and the author of a great book that's coming out soon entitled The Incomparable Honeybee and the Economics of Pollination. So, Dr. Halter, welcome to our show.
Thanks very much, Robert. I'm stoked to be here.
Great. Can I call you Reese?
Please.
Okay, wonderful. So I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you, Reese, is how did you come to be a conservation biologist?
Well, I came by it, quite honestly, at a very, very young age. I was very blessed. I had an awesome mom and dad and an awesome childhood. And at a very young age, Robert, I knew that I loved trees, literally, spiritually, and somehow, some way, I was going to make my life into the tree world. And it really started, again, I say I was blessed. My dad and my little brother Jason and I, every springtime, we planted a couple or more than a couple trees. It became a family ritual, but it really tweaked and piqued my curiosity as a child.
That's great. I guess I had a similar upbringing, but it was elementary particles instead of trees.
Well, there you go, you know, brothers in arms. And one thing always leads to another. And the amazing thing about our planet, and there's so many amazing facts and laws.
Oh, absolutely,
and
yeah.
The amazing thing is that everything is truly interconnected.
Absolutely.
You can't know one thing without being curious about another, and way leads to way, and everything is, as you know, Robert, is interconnected.
Right, absolutely, Reese, yeah. So you love trees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love trees, and I started, and I slugged my way through colleges, and I'm sure I hope there's one or two of my old teachers listening. I'm sure they're scratching their head and saying, gosh, you know, he was kind of an unremarkable student. And yet, you know, I knew...
So was Einstein, by the way.
Wow. Now I'm in exalted company. Thank you. But, you know, I think that the moral of the story maybe is this, that no matter... the Native Americans believe that everyone is born with a purpose. And the trick or the quest really is to find what your purpose is. I speak to thousands of school children each year across the Western Hemisphere. I'm very fortunate to be able to travel and see children and be an ambassador to science. And what I really tell kids is that you've got to dig deep in your well, find out what it really is. And when a child says to me, I want to be a running back for the Dallas Cowboys, and if my answer to them is this, why? And if the child says, because it's in my blood, I feel it, I wake up, I sleep with it, I know I'm going to be there, I can see the twinkle in their eyes, a huge smile lights up on my face, and I say, you know what, you're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they answer, I want to be a movie star, or I want to be a sports figure because of the dollars, wrong answer. If you love what you do, first of all, how can it be considered work? And second of all, the dollars follow it. They can't drive it. And the whole gist of it is find your passion. And I can mm-hmm. speak with experience. You get your passion, it doesn't mean it's your golden ticket to heaven. It means that you roll up your sleeves, you put your head down, and you do, Robert, whatever it takes to get there. And getting there is the ride. Often it takes 20 or 30 years to get to the top of your coveted little anthill. But you know, it's the ride. It's the joy of waking up every morning with a smile, jumping out of bed after you give thanks for being healthy and having a dream and going to get it.
That's such a great message, Reese. So do what you love and work like crazy to succeed at what you're doing and enjoy the path getting there.
Yeah.
It's the path, not the destination.
Amen.
Okay, that's great. So tell us what a conservation biologist actually does.
Okay, well, a conservation biology is a very cool, quite a new discipline in science, or a branch. Conservation biologists are charged with maintaining the genetic tapestry on Earth, life, and all of the little componentries. Now, one of my heroes and one of my mentors and colleagues, Ed Wilson, emeritus professor at Harvard, may be one of the in the biologic world, is thought of as being the biggest living brain. Ed believes that there are at least 10 million different forms of life currently on our planet, but maybe as many as 100 million forms.
Mm.
We have cataloged about 1.6 million forms of life. So the dance now, and it is a dance as we approach 7 billion human beings, is how we can live on this exquisite blue planet without hurting it and stripping it and breaking down all its pieces, intricate pieces in the tapestry of life. So conservation biologists are charged also with not only accumulating information, cataloging new life, but as fast as we get the information, we try and get that to resource managers and government agencies, because I don't care what your business is, the most current information leads to the best decisions. So whatever we did in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or the 80s or the 90s, that's what we did. But we move forward with our knowledge base mm-hmm. so that in biology and in the natural world, we can make better decisions. Now, many of the listeners might be thinking to themselves, oh, here we go, another airy-fairy scientist who's talking about all this highfalutin biology. I didn't quite get biology in high school, and I'm kind of switched off. That's okay, but I can assure you, rich or poor, famous or just a regular guy who does his job, has a beautiful family, and works hard all his life for the man, we all breathe the same air. We all, at the end of the day, drink the water that is fresh water that is on Earth, and we eat from food grown in soil. Now, I've encountered in the last several years an interesting opposition or a mindset, and on the one hand, I can slightly appreciate it, and it's a mindset that goes like this: "Ah, human beings, we there's no way we could impact the Earth globally. This business of global warming or cooling, human beings couldn't impact that if we tried. I'll tell you what, that is not true. And I'll put it to you this way. Go to any beach on planet Earth, any beach, and I'm talking about the high Arctic or the Antarctica, and you will see that human beings have left a fingerprint of our plastics. As a matter of fact, one confounding enormous problem that conservation biologists are looking at this very second is there is almost a continent of plastic floating in the Pacific Ocean. There's two islands. Combined, they would be the size of Texas, and they have been accumulating since the late 40s. This is plastic. It is washing up on some of the beaches in Hawaii to the tune of 10 and 12 feet of plastic a day.
Reese, you say that there's islands in the Pacific that are made of plastic that people have thrown away that are as large as the state of Texas?
Yeah. It's called the Great Garbage Patch. And you see, one of the things that is very apropos is one of the thermodynamic laws, and that is that energy is neither created nor destroyed, it's just transformed.
Mm-hmm.
That's very applicable when you think about it to our present state and this gas, colorless, odorless gas that everybody's heard so much about and probably doesn't want to hear any more about, but they're going to hear a lot more about it, carbon dioxide. You know, trees are an amazing organism, not just because they've been on our planet for over 400 million years and the earliest progenitor of human beings comes in around 7 million years, not just because they're extremely old, not just because they're producing some of the most potent coronary and cancer medicines known to humankind, not just because they are bastions for protecting fresh water, holding snowfall, and releasing it slowly in the springtime, which incidentally in California, we derive 90% of our fresh water from the snowfall accumulation on the Sierra Nevadas,
mm-hmm.
that feeds the eighth mightiest economy on planet Earth and the most intensive agricultural system on the globe. But we're now finding out, in addition to all of that, and their home, they make homes for critters, but the trees are vast carbon dioxide warehouses. That is, they're sucking the CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it in wood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, most of our listeners should know by now that the current challenge on planet Earth today boils down to one word, energy, and how we derive it. Currently, we're using a 19th century technology. What is it? They are fossil fuels. Where did these fossil fuels come from? Our ancient forests of 300-400 million years ago. And the immense accumulation of carbon, because that's carbon dioxide, the gas, is grabbed, it's fixed into wood. Wood is primarily carbon, and over tens and hundreds of millions of years, the lush forests that accumulated on our globe grew, and then they fell down, grew and fell down, and the weight and the proximity to the heat from the outer mantle in our beautiful Earth transformed the carbon into fossil fuels in some cases. And in other cases, I might add, some of it was transformed into the purest form of carbon, diamonds.
Ooh.
But it's how we, so when we burn our fossil fuels today as a byproduct of that, we are releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is potent in its ability to trap the sun. sun's energy. The trapping of the sun's energy is part of the equation. The back part of the equation, which is extremely alarming, is the amount, the importance of glaciers and snow on our planet cannot be underestimated, because snow has an extremely high reflectability. That is, the incoming solar radiation, when it hits the Arctic and the Antarctic and all of the glaciers in the mountains, they reflect that incoming radiation. With the melting of the snow, we are uncategorically warming up, and this is a big concern. And also, we are removing old forests. We need to protect the old forests. The old forests are our watersheds, and as it turns out, these great giant trees are fantastic, even though they're not reaching for the sun, because the race in the biologic world is why trees are tall is they race up to the sun so that they can crowd out their competition. Then they grow fat. The big fat trees are very important because they continue to add cells around their circumference, and that, in the sheer size of them, pulls out an immense amount of CO2. I see in today's paper in the LA Times that Governor Schwarzenegger realizes this, and kudos to Marriott International and Conservation International, because they are renting 1.5 million acres a year of undisturbed rainforest to offset their footprint.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we are talking about energy and the environment with Dr. Reese Halter.
Now, let's go from the Amazon up to the Pacific Northwest, because the Pacific Northwest is the last contiguous stretch of old-growth temperate rainforest. True, many of them are what we call patches and quilts because we've opened them up, but we need a moratorium on all the remaining old growth to be our vast vacuum, as it were, to suck this CO2 out of the atmosphere. Forestry is not about going in and ripping down what Mother Nature grew and moving on. No, that is resource extraction. Now, if you're going to do resource extraction, say it. Don't say forestry. Forestry is no different in a way than a field of wheat or agriculture, in that we're going to practice it. We plant it, we tend it, we harvest it well within a human lifespan. As a matter of fact, many would say well within 25 years. We've denuded enough land on Earth now that we should only be harvesting wood that we can grow within 20 to 30 years. Rotate.
Okay, so these great forests that we should be preserving are providing us with water. They're providing us with the oxygen that we breathe.
Yes.
And they are absorbing the carbon dioxide that would otherwise increase the temperature of the planet and lead to further aggravate global warming.
Yes. And medicines. We are finding medicines. Here's an interesting little factoid. We often think that medicines only come from the Amazon or the Indonesian, Southeast Asian forests. Not true. There's a small little tree, a spindly-looking tree, if you looked at it compared to the giants in the Pacific Northwest, the Pacific Yew tree. From the Pacific Yew tree comes the blockbuster billion-dollar drug Taxol that in the 80s they first started to trial on ovarian cancer, successful. Breast cancer, successful. Coronary disease, successful. Lung cancer, successful. And now it's even being used with AIDS. This tree is phenomenal. How many other medicines, Robert, are there out there We don't know, but if we destroy these systems, we'll never know.
Well, what are the other costs to the environment of burning fossil fuels in the 19th century way that you were talking about?
Well, what comes to mind is one of the costs are plastics. Plastics are a petroleum byproduct, and plastics are very difficult to break down. The molecular constituency of plastics are these long, very long chain polymers. And kudos to both Cargill, that has looked at how to replace plastics with soybeans, and kudos to DuPont, who has looked at taking corn molecules and making a replacement for plastics with them. And as it turns out, they have succeeded. It is now a case where the fossil fuels are inexpensive enough so that plastics are convenient in terms of a way of delivering products to the market, but they are choking our oceans. And the other concern is the amount of oil drips on the road. They are washed into our waterways, and they're either winding up in lakes or they're winding up eventually in the ocean. And we are very slowly but surely polluting and toxifying ourselves. Not acceptable. The other thing that we know a lot about, Robert, which we are on the precipice of a very difficult situation, and that is where we are in agriculture and being highly dependent on liquid fertilizers, and we are beating the dickens out of life in the soil world. Now, I know listeners are going to go, oh, no, here comes a geeky scientist who's going to talk about dirt. Well, the world of dirt is fascinating, and the world of dirt is filled with life. Bacteria, fungus, protozoans, and there are trillions and trillions and trillions of forms of life. The problem that we are faced with today is that with our liquid fertilizers, we're killing that. And
so tell us, Reese, why we should care about these trillions of forms of life that make their living in the dirt.
Well, because those trillions of forms of life in the dirt are what help our crops grow healthy and strong. And for every problem, Robert, there are at least three solutions. Because when you think about it, the only thing a human being is really good at is solving problems. That's why we excel with something we hope between our ears, our brains. And we now know there's a movement worldwide afoot to feed the soil what's called a compost, and that is essentially all of the natural ingredients that make up soil. You know, what is soil? Well, soil appears to be all the dead organic material that falls away in a forest after the above ground life sheds its leaves, its barks, its twig, etc. But it actually, the soil world is alive, and there are organisms that are making a living, just like you and I and our listeners, and they need to be fed new forms of organic material, that means dead plant life, so that they can continue to build and continue to grow incredible amounts of vegetation. Our Great Plains grassland is one of the most remarkable ecosystems on Earth, and we have done a heck of a job farming it. But you know, before we whiteys got here and started to take a European method of being pretty hard on the land, you got to remember that the great grasslands and the plains were home to some amazing life, tens and tens of millions of buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And then before that, the Ice Age mega mammals that we had the equivalent of the Serengeti Plains with diversity of life. That all happened because the soil was able to grow vegetation and the animals were able to defecate. All the defecation and dung fed into the soil and made it more fertile.
I've heard you say in the past, Reese, that in nature there's no such thing as waste.
True, true. And that, you know, that leads us, Robert, into an entirely wonderful new field called biomimicry and nature's blueprint, which is a movement afoot that believes fervently that all of the answers for our industries and our way of life are already in nature's web of life, and all we as a species need to do is follow the pathway.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most classic examples in biomimicry, which really means just mimicking the biology in nature, is the story of the Swiss engineer who was walking his dog in the 40s through an open field. They both came home, and they were covered in burrs. Well, you know, human minds are ingenious. That wonderful engineer scientist took the burr and he thought, God, what if I made a material that kind of mimicked that? Guess where Velcro came from? But in the 40s and 50s when he brought it to market, and this is a good story because the word no, ladies and gentlemen, means go away and regroup. It doesn't mean throw your books down and walk away. If you got a great idea, never let somebody or many people tell you it isn't worthy. Because what the scientist did after everybody said, oh, the sound of the Velcro pulling apart is terrible. I'd never have that on me or in any products. For 20 years, Velcro was used in heart surgery, heart valves inside human beings before Neil Armstrong ripped off his glove after coming back from being on the moon. And people said, what is that cool thing you got there? And Velcro needs no further introduction.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you talk in the past about another environmental impact of our burning coal, and that is the mercury issue. Could you tell the listeners about that a little bit?
Yeah, the mercury issue is a real deal because currently the number one form of energy, and this can't be stressed any further, without energy, our species as is incapable of living. When you go home, you turn on a light or you put something in the microwave or have a piece of toast. The number one source of energy currently on planet Earth is coal. And coal powers down our nation. It powers down the Australian continent. It is a major, major source of energy for China and many, many other countries. What we're seeing today, one of the fallout and byproducts of burning coal, and there are several, but one of them, the neurotoxin mercury vapor. Now, mercury is released in a gas form when we burn coal.
Mm-hmm.
And make no mistake, a piece of coal the size of your fist packs an incredible punch of energy. And when it is burned, mercury vapor is one of the byproducts. It circulates in the atmosphere for at least a year, maybe a year and a half, and it eventually comes down, falls to the earth, in most cases up in the Arctic. The point is, it gets into our oceans, and it's not it's not that we don't know or people aren't aware of mercury warnings on the back of tuna cans. If you're pregnant, you mustn't ingest too much tuna each month. But mercury is now in all life from the ocean. And the oceans are a godsend because they feed billions of people on a daily basis. And we do not want to eat mercury because it is a terrible, terrible neuro poison.
Well, can we suggest some things to our listeners? Some of our younger listeners still have an opportunity to become conservation biologists,
yeah.
but some of us perhaps are a little beyond that stage when we could make that choice. So what can the rest of us do, without sacrificing our entire standard of living, to have a beneficial effect on these substantial problems that you've talked about?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that, because the facts are this. Each of us now, as I said earlier, with the most current information, it leads to the best decisions. And each of us have a role. Each of us must put in a hand, because if each of us put in a hand, I equate that to a Super Bowl ring at the end of the day. If you do one thing, only one thing differently, and you tell two people and ask them to do one thing differently, and they tell two people, it will spread like wildfire. I suggest some simple things. For instance, I have for the longest time shopped with a couple of organic cotton bags. I go to the supermarket, I do my shopping, come in, unpack my goods, and the second thing after I put everything away, mostly the perishables in the fridge or the freezer, I take my three bags and I put them right back in the car so that I don't forget that I have them. Reducing the amount of plastic is crucial. Plastic comes from petroleum. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but another thing that is happening is right before our very eyes, we're having a massive wealth distribution. We in America are working hard every day, and we're spending our hard-earned dollars to buy petroleum products from the Middle East. We need to take control of our destiny and not give our hard-earned dollars to the Middle East. We need to cut back. So by using these bags is a good thing. The other thing that might help people is, instead of doing six chores in six different rides in your car, how about make a list? And how about doing all of your chores, six or eight in a row, and then how about taking one day a week and making sure at least one day a week, I wish it was every day, but one day a week, why don't you walk 2 miles? Walk 2 miles, walk to wherever you need to do your chores, or just walk, because walking is a crucial form of exercise, oxygenating the body and staving off this terrible onset of diabetes type 2, which afflicts over 25 million Americans, and we can prevent that, Robert. Lastly, buy organic foods. It is now nationwide, from Sam's Club to Safeway, Vons and Pavilions in California. They have organic bays in our stores, and this is very elemental. When the scale of economy ramps up, which it has, the price falls down. Do not, under any circumstances, if you can help it, eat foods that have been doused in pesticides. They weaken our autoimmune system, and they make us weak and susceptible to disease. Buy organics.
Well, that's a lot to think about, and that's a great discussion of what we're doing to our environment, and particularly what we're doing to our environment because of the way we make energy, as you describe, in the 19th century fashion. You know, we'd love to have you back another time, Rhys. Would you be available?
Sure, I'd love to come and chat.
Okay,
thank you. Okay,
great. Okay, well, we want to thank Dr. Rhys Halter for joining us today. He has a website where you can find out a lot more information about the things that he's talking about. It's drreese.com. That's D-R for doctor, Rhys, R-E-E-S-E, drreese.com. And he has a book coming out very soon, and I was privileged to have an advanced copy. It's a wonderful book. It makes great reading. It's called The Incomparable Honeybee and the Economics of Pollination. So that'll be available soon. Rhys, it's going to be at Amazon.com. And
yeah, it's on Amazon. It's also on in Barnes & Noble and Borders and on their website. So have a little gander. It's an easy read, and I think everybody's going to enjoy it.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today, Dr.
Cheers.
Rhys Halter. Join us again next week when we explore Talking to Space with Gene Burke. Thank you for joining us today, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.